I'm a huge fan of utopias and particularly dystopias. I never read about utopian places. I feel like I exclusively read dystopias like We and 1984 and Brave New World and Day of the Oprichnik. Okay, great. I'm going to count myself in. Hello and welcome to Securities, a podcast and newsletter devoted to science, technology, finance, and the human condition. I'm your host, Danny Crichton, and today we're talking with Tina Seelig on inventing the future. Tina is executive director of the Knight Hennessy Scholars Program at Stanford University, teaches classes at Stanford's D School, and is the author of Creativity Rules, Get Ideas Out of Your Head and Into the World, as well as What I Wish I Knew When I Was 20. Tina, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Delighted to be here.
And also joining me today is my Lux partner, Grace Isford. Grace, welcome as well.
Thanks, Danny. So excited to have Tina here.
I think when people hear air quotes, Stanford and startups, there's this belief that the university has this perfectly integrated, well-oiled machine for propelling one founder after another into Silicon Valley. But in reality, it's far more decentralized, an agglomeration of different schools, institutes, student groups, incubators, and a lot of them don't talk to each other. And Tina, to me, you're one of the core integrators trying to connect the dots across this archipelago of entrepreneurial energy. And I'd love to just start with sort of the lay of the land of Stanford and startups in this sort of 2022 post-pandemic period as sort of students and faculty are now back on campus.
Well, that's an easy question to start with. You know, Stanford is a really interesting place. I was reflecting yesterday with a friend of mine about coming to the Bay Area and coming to Stanford for the first time and just being intoxicated by the entrepreneurial spirit. And I think that's what really makes the magic happen is that people not only come to the Valley expecting this, there is a lot of cultural support for innovation and entrepreneurship. So you're right, it's completely decentralized. There is very much a culture of let a thousand million flowers bloom and see what happens. There are entrepreneurship programs in all of the different schools at Stanford, and we are very loosely connected, sharing resources, talking to each other, very, very collaborative. And that's what makes it really exciting is that it's not a tops-down program. It's very much bottoms up, motivated and driven by the individuals who are inspired to make things happen.
I totally agree. I mean, I was excited to come to Stanford because of that. There was this kind of air of intellectual curiosity and almost collaboration on campus, irrespective of your discipline. Tina and I originally met via the Mayfield Fellowship Program, which is an incredible work study tech program at Stanford, and really encouraged that kind of proliferation of ideas and cross-pollination, whether or not, you know, you're an English major, engineering major, but had an interest solving big problems.
So let me ask, Tina, you've been teaching this class, Inventing the Future, and you're looking at the frontier sciences and technology area. So I'd love to hear a little bit of how that class is designed, because when I was reading about it, first of all, I feel like I was at Stanford. I started in 07, which was, I think, prior to the D School. I think the D School got kind of propped up either very late in my career at Stanford. But there are no courses in which we're sort of experimental, experiential, get out into the world, invent the future, look over the, and in your case, I think it's over the next 50 years at what's potential going forward. So let's talk a little bit about the structure of the course and why you designed it the way you did.
Yeah. So let me start with why I designed this class and who I collaborate with and why we're doing this. It started about 5 years ago when I was looking out at how quickly the world was changing and seeing that our students were going out in the world and they were the ones who were changing it. They were inventing new technologies, new tools, new trends. And they were so optimistic and so excited about what they were doing, but not necessarily looking at the consequences, the long-term consequences of what they were doing, both the utopian consequences, but also the dystopian consequences of what they were doing. And I thought, it's irresponsible for us not to be inoculating them with the tools and the mindset to think about what the consequences are of what they're doing. So I pitched this idea to my colleagues at D School, and they connected me with Lisa Solomon, who is a futurist who's on their team. And so we got together and it was clear that this was a match that was really well made. And so we started crafting the class. And then I was talking to the class with a colleague in the bioengineering department. And he said, I want to be on the teaching team. And we said, come join us. So one is Lisa Solomon, who's at the D School, who's the futurist. And then Drew Endy, who's a very, very well-established bioengineering professor, who is very much thinking about the future and the future of the future, the future, the future, the future. And so the three of us together have crafted this course over the last number of years. The class is structured in a really fun way. The first half of the course, so the class is 10 weeks long, the first 5 weeks, we teach tools, techniques, approaches, mindset. How do you invent the future? How do you come up with big ideas and think about what the consequences of those are? And then the last 5 weeks are debates. And each week, we take a different frontier technology. And the students are put on teams. They knew their teams in advance, so they were doing advanced research. They didn't know if they were going to be debating the utopian or dystopian consequences. And so a week before, we let them know, and they have to basically say, okay, let's imagine this comes to life, this technology. What's it going to look like in 50 years? What's the really rosy picture? And what's the really deep, dark future? And how might we think about integrating those to come up with something that we really want to experience?
What has been most surprising? So you're doing this utopian dystopia dichotomy, and I'm going back to Thomas More's original utopia, which was actually a dystopia. And, you know, they're really two sides of the same coin, because it allows you to sort of see both how the same phenomena can be perceived in two different directions. I'm curious, though, as you look at these different technologies, you know, what surprised you? Because I think of like AI, and there's sort of obvious answers of how that could be a utopic, you know, Star Trekian, you know, everything is done for you, everything's super easy, or a dystopian, you know, digital surveillance, we can't do anything. But I'm curious, like, when you see some of the projects some of the students have come up with, what are some of the technologies you thought either were more utopic than you might have expected or more dystopic than might have otherwise been?
Well, as you point out, they all are both, right? It's the different sides of the same coin. One of the most interesting things that you see, though, is we have for each of the sessions where we're doing debates, we have an expert in that field, someone who is literally working on the front lines, come to our class and listen to the debates and give feedback. And the most surprising, interesting thing that happens is they often are surprised by the dystopian space because they never have taken the time to think about that.
I'm curious, have you seen differences across all these different students over time? Do they have different needs?
Oh my
gosh.
They
have different frameworks? Are they coming with different kind of things in their knapsack, so to speak? What have you seen this change over the years?
That's such an interesting question. I can point to discontinuities in what happens with the students because they are a reflection of what's going on in the world. I think about the Mayfield Fellows class of 2000 and the World Trade Center 2001. I think about that year, and the students are in the class the spring, the summer, and the fall. So we had these students spring and summer, they went off and they came back right after September 11th, 2001.
Wow.
They were different students. It was literally within the same class. They came back. That experience so shaped who they were. They were busily thinking about how they were going to make money and how they were going to make their place in the world. And they came back and everybody was like, what do I do? I need to do something to make the world a better place. It was amazing. Then after 2008, I had a big surprise. So I imagined that after the financial crisis in 2008, that people would go rushing to security. But it was actually the opposite. People said, before, there was a big difference in the risk profile of going into consulting or finance and going into a startup. People who had a pretty low risk profile were much more likely to go into these traditional fields. But after that financial meltdown, especially in the financial world, guess what? All of a sudden, that difference became much less measurable. And people started running to starting companies. So there was a huge increase in entrepreneurship. I bet if you looked at it, you would see this in 2008-9 when people said, you know what, I need to have more agency in my life. I'm going to go start my own business.
I think I've seen the exact same pattern because I was at Stanford 07 through 11. And what I would say is the people who really were successful was that class who went into the great financial crisis. All the jobs that traditionally Goldman Sachs, McKinsey pulled offers, no one got them. They didn't hire anyone. And it wasn't a route you could choose. And it was like that door was closed, which meant you had to do something new. And at the time that was mobile, you know, the iPhone was released in 07, the App Store comes out in 08, 09. And so there's a whole cohort of folks who otherwise probably would have been a banker on Wall Street who are like, well, app stores and these new apps that are getting built in the mobile ad networks, that's the only thing available. I'm going to go do that. And that just happened to be where a lot of the innovation and the locus, like this is where, you know, Facebook comes out of, all the way up to like Instagram in 2012 comes out of that cohort. And then back to my class in 2011, it came back to a lot more traditional because the jobs had reopened up and folks were sort of back on track again. So I just think it's fascinating to see that macro environment, particularly in this year, 2022, with the recessionary headwinds, with people getting worried. We've seen several folks lose their jobs on LinkedIn. It's very traumatic. But my guess is if they can sort of persevere the next couple of years, these will be some of the most successful people doing some of the most interesting stuff just simply because those conventional doors are closed.
I'd add just one other discontinuity was with COVID. You saw everyone losing that sort of social, familial, communal aspect, whether it was on campus or in their workplace in person. And I think we're still working to kind of get back to normal, and folks are still trying to figure out, you know, the mix of in-person versus virtual, and then reevaluating a lot of what jobs actually excite them versus, you know, maybe what jobs they had to do just because they were in X, Y, or Z location, for example.
Oh my goodness. I mean, that is just a huge discontinuity. And of course, it wasn't just one day or one month with the stock market or one year. We've now had, you know, over 2 years. It'll be fascinating to see what happens, especially to younger people who this was a very pivotal time of their life, how that's going to shape the way they craft their lives going forward.
Talk to me a little bit about defining traits of inventive and creative people that often people overlook.
It's funny because people often ask questions like, can you teach creativity? Can you teach entrepreneurship? Can you teach leadership? And I just smile because we don't ask those questions about other topics like math and history and even sports or art. There's something about these fields that we feel are innate. And of course, there are some people who are going to be naturally more creative than others. And there are going to be people who are naturally more entrepreneurial. But all of these involve skills and traits, you know, mindset. And these can be taught. These can be changed. Just like, you know, we know that people can change their mindset to be a growth mindset. And I think so much of being an innovator is about learning to be optimistic, learning to take risks, learning how to be resilient, learning how to gather lots of data from lots of different places, because so many ideas come from connecting and combining other information, right? So in order to be creative, the more diverse your inputs, the more diverse your output is going to be as well. There are very specific tools you can teach, and I am a huge believer that everybody can get better at learning to be more creative, innovative, entrepreneurial, and to build their leadership skills.
Carol Dweck, which you referred to with sort of the growth mindset, I believe also at Stanford, if I recall, over maybe the School of Education. I think it's part of this kind of vanguard of new folks, which is saying that there's a lot more neural plasticity, that we actually have the ability to change who we are. We have the ability to adapt. We have the ability to gain these sort of softer skills. Because I agree with you, Tina. I think there's this huge cultural bias that says that you're a born leader. You know, you're born to be president or born. And, you know, there are sort of a sense of like, yes, there are some 5-year-olds who are taking charge of the group or whatever the case may be. But ultimately, like, well, how do you go do that? That's learnable. You can see it. You can watch it. You can observe it. We were just hosting a group of maybe, 30 or 40 young people just a few days ago here in New York City. And Josh Wolf, one of our partners here, was talking about his career. And he was like, look, you know, I used to be really awkward. I didn't know how to talk to people. I had a huge accent. No one took me seriously. And then over 10 years, like I watched videos, I saw how people spoke. I saw how they slowed down and started speaking with a more careful cadence. And he adapted and he gained a lot of power and built up Lux Capital simply by just changing who he was. And now he's still the same person. He still has the same core. But it was not something that was just like, well, I was born to be a venture capitalist on day two. He worked very hard to adapt his mindset and lifestyle to go and approach it. I want to talk specifically about leadership, though, because one of the things you teach is just focused on the leadership aspect. So I think you know, entrepreneurship is about risk-taking, creativity is about design thinking and bringing up new ideas and redefining the question, as you put it in earlier. But then we get to leadership, which is, you know, how do you manage people? How do you recruit? How do you build esprit de corps among a group of folks who oftentimes have to take the same risks that you are taking, oftentimes for less reward, particularly in these early stage startups where, you know, it's sort of a wing and a prayer. And so I'm curious how you sort of teach the leadership aspects in your courses.
Yeah, so I am fortunate enough to be the executive director of Knight Hennessy Scholars at Stanford, where our goal is bringing together students from across the university to create this multicultural, multidisciplinary community focused on being global leaders. So this is what, you know, I eat for breakfast is thinking about this. And we've put together a leadership model over the last couple of years, looking at the traits of leaders, but also the behaviors of leaders. So sort of think of traits as thinking, you know, who are you and how do people perceive who you are? But then what is it that you actually do? And so many of our programs that we offer here and that we deliver to these students is about looking at the actual behaviors, how to be inspiring, how to be creative, how to be collaborative or analytical, how to make hard decisions, and how to be action oriented. So those six things, right? Inspiring, creative, collaborative, analytical, decisive, and action-oriented. And all of our programming is designed to reinforce the skills that are required. So for example, inspiring, the first year students come in and they learn storytelling skills. And then, you know, decision-making, for example, we do a lot of case studies, living cases. We have people come in from across disciplines and present the scholars with really hard problems that they are working on right now or things that they've dealt with in the past. The scholars get to try to crack the case, you know, how might you address this? And then they get feedback on it. So they're getting real life experience honing these skills.
I think two things I'd add to that, which again, are characteristic of a lot of the really awesome to me entrepreneurship classes and leadership classes I've ever been a part of, is they're both experiential. So learning by doing in many cases and putting yourself out there and forcing yourself to ask, you know, the why or why not questions, and also holistic nature, right? So they're interdisciplinary, often bringing together many different folks with different interests or perspectives or backgrounds or insights. And then often, you know, realizing that there's, you know, hundreds or if not thousands of ways of approaching different problem or, you know, opportunity.
I couldn't agree more that learning has to be experiential. In fact, I think as an educator, I am really an experience designer, and I never give homework at the beginning to read in advance. I only give readings after the experience. So I want people to come in really a blank slate, and then we'll do some reading about it, about the power of this tool. But now you have a hook. Now you have the experience to hang that learning on, and it becomes much more sticky. You're much more likely to remember it and to be able to apply it later.
I'd love to talk a little bit more about Tina's theory on luck. If you can increase your luck, or if it's innate. Being in New York, I actually think my luck has increased quite a bit because of the pure nature of how many people I bump into, you know, millions of people in this city. Highly dense and concentrated, and then, you know, continue to run into different people from different parts of life in a way to collaborate on a new business endeavor or friendship in a way that maybe I wouldn't have previously. But Tina, would love to turn it over to you.
Gosh, I love talking about luck. You know, when I grew up, my father used to always say, the harder I work, the luckier I get. And I realized, you know, that was great, but that is just the tip of the iceberg is hard work. I am fascinated by luck. In fact, I gave a TED talk on luck, on how you can take a little risk to increase your luck. And what I realized is that there are three ways to increase your luck. And first of all, luck is really different from fortune and chance. People tend to conflate them all, right? Fortune is something that happens to you. Like, I'm fortunate to have been born at this place and time. I'm fortunate to have these parents, et cetera. Chance is something that's much more random, like, you know, throwing the dice. But luck is in the middle. It's something where there's this wonderful interplay between what you do and what happens. And I think that there are three major ways to increase your luck. One is to change your relationship with yourself. And that's lots of mindset change, where you're willing to take more risks and to get out of your comfort zone. Now, you know, Grace, you just said meet more people. That's one, right? Take some social risks, introduce yourself to new people, follow up with people, you know, sort of invite new people into their world. But there are lots of other ways to increase your personal risk profile, whether it's financial risks or social risks or emotional risks or physical risks. These are all different types of risks you can take that you can stretch to make you luckier, because the more things you try, the more likely that something's going to work well. The flip side of this is also making sure that you have a failure resume, because you want to make sure that you collect all the things you learned from what didn't work out, right? So if I tried something and it didn't work, oops, I put in my resume, I mine it for some insights, and then I move on. The key is to not get stuck if you have something that didn't work and feel like you can't do it again. So one is changing your relationship with yourself. The other is changing your relationship with other people. I think so many people do not follow through, and my personal favorite, as Grace knows, is thank you notes. I think most people do not send thank you notes, and they do not show appreciation. And showing appreciation is one of the most powerful things you can do in the world, because it strengthens that relationship so much more. If you read my book or watched my TED talk and you send me a note and said, Tina, I watched your talk, it was really meaningful to me, thank you so much for taking the time to do it, you're now in my inbox. If a year later you write to me and follow up on that email thread and say, oh, by the way, you know, I was thinking about this, you know, might you know someone, I've already have a positive relationship with you because you had thanked me for something. It's just the way the world works. I know that we all sort of keep a mental calculation of whether we do something for someone, and if they don't say thank you, if you've put yourself out there, you know, the next time they ask, they're going to be surprised that somehow you don't have time for it.
Love to go back to Inventing the Future class and talk a little bit more about some of those interesting or surprising patterns you found.
At the beginning of the course, the first day, we have all the students line up in a line based on how optimistic or pessimistic they are about the future. And so some people are way optimists, some are saying pessimists, a lot are in the middle. And then we have them walk forward if they feel that they have a lot of agency in terms of shaping the future, or walk backwards if they think that they do not have any agency or control over the future. And we sort of take a snapshot of this. And if we were on Zoom, we do it as a little 2x2 matrix, then they literally map it on the screen. We revisit this at the end of the course. And the most amazing thing happens. The students in the course feel so much more agency about the future. When asked to reflect upon their biggest takeaways from the course, many of them say, I now feel that the future isn't happening to me, but I'm happening to the future. And it's so interesting that they walk away after learning these tools feeling as though they have much more control over shaping the future that they will live in.
I'd probably be on the extra room to the left on the pessimistic side, through the wall in the next conference room, probably in the back wall in the other conference room. So several rooms away.
But do you have agency?
No agency.
Okay.
The future just slams you into the ground. That would be where I am. But I will say, I think one of the activities, though, which I feel like this is partly inspired by, is Stanford in the dorms always had this activity called Crossing the Line, in which mm-hmm. they would ask these questions. And it was just like, you know, step forward if some scenario had happened to you. It was a trust building exercise. And to me, that was one of the most powerful experiences you ever had, because people feel very unsafe to talk about these things individually, but oftentimes feel much more comfortable in a group setting. Where they're with trusted peers, people in their dorms, people to say, you know, did you experience trauma as a child? Did you have something terrible happen? And then they see that there are others who have shared the exact same experiences as you. So I think it's really powerful both to identify where everyone else stands and also see how it changes and to realize that the world is a dynamic place, particularly when you're a young person just going through college. Tina, thank you so much for joining us.
It was my pleasure.